Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings to all of you from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Thanks for spending some time with us tonight. We promise to do our best to make it worth your while. You know, I know what the calendar says and when the seasons officially change, but as far as I'm concerned, summer started today, at least in Las Vegas. We finally had a triple-digit weekend, our first of the year. Today we hit 104 degrees, which tied the record high for this date. And here in the late evening, it's still mighty toasty out there in the Mojave. A good night to stay inside in the air conditioning and ride it out with Coast to Coast. But that's true no matter where you are. We have some fun adventures to explore with you tonight. Two guests with their own unique take on the paranormal, encounters with the unknown, right down the middle of the strike zone for Coast to Coast. As regular listeners know, we often explore tales of chance meetings between humans and otherworldly entities. There are so many names for them, and they've been reported in so many forms through the centuries, but there are certain common threads that run through these stories, both the factual modern accounts and long-ago stories that have sort of been categorized as folklore. One of the commonalities is food and drink, things that are shared, exchanged, offered, or declined during these odd encounters with, take your pick, aliens, monsters, trolls, elves, fairy folk, Sasquatch, little green men, large hairy women, Valkyries, goblins, angels, witches, you name it. You know, I remember when I first got started chasing after UFO stories. This was back in the sort of the late 80s. There was a tale floating around at the time. It was really hot stuff in the UFO field. It was a rumor, really, that the U.S. military had in its custody for a time, maybe still did at that moment, an alien or two, either as captives or they were in protection or they were in cahoots with the government, maybe in underground lairs or bases. And the story that was told, I think it was broadcast on a nationwide UFO TV special, is that the alien visitor or visitors had developed a fondness for strawberry ice cream. And I wondered at the time if that story had been planted as kind of a way for debunkers to make fun of or belittle the larger story, the larger mystery, or whether there was a basis in fact for this tale. I still don't know the answer, but it did get me and others thinking back then about what, if anything, these visitors might eat when they get here, assuming they eat anything at all. That same question has been pondered through the ages by people all over the world, but it wasn't until just recently that anyone gathered up all of those stories from throughout history, right from the first bite of forbidden fruit in the garden, right up to Whitley Strieber's chilling encounters with bug-eyed intruders, and put all the stuff into a book. Joshua Cutchin is new to Coast, but after reading his book, A Trojan Feast, I have a feeling we're going to be hearing a lot more from him in the future. It is so much fun to read, gathers together so many bits and pieces of stories from far-flung realms and sources. We're going to jump right into that material in just a moment. And you will have a chance to chat with Joshua as well later on. We'll save some time for calls to come in and comments as well. And then in the second half of the program tonight, encounters with the unknown that are not very friendly at all. No point where any meals are shared. We're talking about strange but persistent stories told by people who say they came face to face with reptoids, reptilian beings. Often these encounters happen in caves or underground places. Is it even remotely possible a race of creatures like this could coexist on Earth, have been here a long time? Seems far-fetched, but the stories, again, are eerily similar, and they're not all that rare either. Lon Strickler is a paranormal researcher and collector of tales of the unknown, from Bigfoot and other crypto creatures to hauntings and UFO sightings. His blog, Phantoms and Monsters, is read by thousands of people every day, including me. One of his recent pieces was about these reptoid encounters, and I thought that's a good hook and a good reason to have Lon back on the program. He will dazzle us with eyewitness accounts that he has gathered, not only about reptoids, but other strange beings as well. Lon will join us in Hour 3 tonight, and we'll carve out some time for you listeners to ask questions or share your stories with him if you've got something out there that you want to get off your chests. Thank you for all the hundreds of emails you've sent me regarding last night's program on animal abuses and factory farming. Based on the comments that I've received, it looks like we struck a nerve with that discussion. And I'm so glad the guests that we interviewed were able to talk about what happens on the front lines of the animal welfare wars. If you missed that program, you can still hear it along with hundreds of other archive shows, interviews by George Norrie and our other Coast colleagues. You go to the Coast to Coast website and click on the link that tells you how to become a Coast Insider. It costs pennies a day. It allows you to listen to the program at your convenience, day or night, as many times as you want to listen. It's a really good deal. And then while you're on the website, check out the section called Naps News. Webmaster Tim Benall and I have put together our usual eclectic collection of items and oddities culled from various news sources. Tim has highlighted a story about the search for Amelia Earhart's plane. Some investigators think they might be getting pretty close to finally resolving that enduring mystery. Under the Naps News banner, I posted a recent story from our second guest, Lon Strickler, about reptoids, just to kind of get you in the mood for that. Also, their speculation about a carving attributed to Sasquatch. Couple of stories about problems people might have in communicating with little green men or other aliens. Some recent objects captured on film or video that may or may not be legit UFOs, I mean. And maybe the most important story of them all, at least the ones we have posted, new statements from Edward Snowden, whistleblower, who hints that as big as the revelations were about sneaky worldwide surveillance on an unimaginable scale, the biggest revelations, he says, are still to come. Bigger than the NSA listening to all of our phone calls, reading all of our emails, storing all of our electronic communications in government data bases and centers. If it's bigger than that, I want to know what it is. That and more on the Coast website. Check it out when you have a moment. For now, though, time to bring in the dog, feed the cat, put on a big pot of strong coffee, fluff up the pillow, jump into those jammies, and plop yourself down in the Barca lounger, because we are ready to rumble. Back in a moment with the food of the gods, a Trojan feast. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Joshua Cutchin is a native of North Carolina with a long interest in Fortiana. He holds a master's degree in music literature and a master's in journalism from the University of Georgia, good school. He currently works as a public affairs specialist, and in addition to media work, he's a published composer, actively performs as a jazz and rock tuba player. Wait a second, what? A rock tuba player, is that right, Joshua?
Yeah, such things do exist.
You're my first. You're my first.
Well, hey, that's good to know. It's an honor.
Welcome to the program, man. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this book. When your publisher sent me a note and started to describe it, I said, stop right there in the first sentence. It sounded great, and it exceeded all expectations. Tell me how you got started down this road.
Well, you know, I've had a long interest in these sort of subjects, and I guess you would call me sort of a monster kid growing up. If it had a monster or a dinosaur or a creature, I was all over it. So that interest sort of naturally grew into an interest in the unexplained, UFOs and Sasquatch, and even fairies as well. And I was for a long time quite aware of the what a lot of people call the food taboo, which is the idea that to consume food from a fairy would mean that you were trapped in the fairy land for all eternity. And I noticed parallels between this and a lot of abductee and contactee lore, where a lot of these people who claim to have been taken by certain entities have been given liquids or pills or, in some contactee cases, fruit and bread. So I'd always noticed that correlation, but it really didn't strike me that there was a correlation between aliens, fairies, and Sasquatch in this realm until I was reading J. Robert Alley's Raincoast Sasquatch, which is a great book that I recommend anyone pick up. But I can even remember the moment to this day when I actually noticed this parallel. I read where it said that some Native American tribes believed that if you took food from Tsunokwa, the Sasquatch, that you were doomed to be trapped with the Sasquatch forever. And at that moment, I just stopped and said to myself, there are way too many similarities here. Somebody's got to write a book on this. And it became apparent that no one was going to, so I decided to do it myself. And it took me down this rabbit hole that had a lot more interesting Warrens than I thought it did. So,
well, I'm amazed how far reaching you extended the net and gathered information. I'm also amazed that for a first time author on this subject, you didn't get sucked into the normal traps. You didn't stake out some turf and defend it. You didn't insist that all these stories are perfectly legitimate or they're exactly as the witness described it. You sort of said, you operate under some assumptions. You take them at their word for purposes of the discussion, but you don't lock yourself in any position, which is pretty smart.
Well, that really means a lot to hear that, because I really tried to just take the data on as much as I could, take a look at all the different facets of what was going on, and try to have the data lead me to a conclusion versus, having it the other way around and having a position that I was coming from. So I really appreciate you saying that.
Of course, the problem, as it's noted in the foreword, Thomas Bullard writes the foreword, and he talks about anomalies being these personal encounters, and that's, he says in his words, it's their lifeblood. Some would say their only substance. Some anomalies appear to be physical phenomena, behave like physical events, but for a lot of them, we really don't know, which makes your work all the more tougher. The idea would seem preposterous to somebody who doesn't think there's any substance to any of these stories, that these beings, A, would eat or drink anything, since in their minds they don't exist at all.
Exactly. And, I learned a long time ago that there is no elevator pitch for this book. there's a lot of background that you have to give somebody regarding the food taboo as to even broach the subject as to why this might be important. It's interesting, in the Western world, we tend to separate things into having an objective reality and a subjective reality, and I'm not entirely sure that there isn't some place in between. I feel like all our five senses are really interpreting the world around us and taking that into our brains, and from there we actually get an idea of what the world is around us. So in some sense, everything that we do every day is subjective. It's objective being interpreted into subjective.
You cite Jacques Vallée's work several times during the book, which I think is a great addition, because he's covered just a tiny slices of what you cover in this book in different points. But, of course, listeners to this program know about Vallée's work and how he's drawn parallels between modern aliens and ancient elves and fairies and things of that sort. What's your gut on that? Is the commonality more than the food and drink stories? Are they the same things in different forms, or do you not want to commit?
Well, I think I'm going to refrain from committing again, as per sort of me letting the data sort of guide me into a certain place. The only thing that I really feel incredibly comfortable saying is that there is a connection there. Now, whether that means that they are the same thing, or two sides of the same thing, or two different things that share similar attributes, I'm not entirely sure. You look at a lot of the foods that are administered between aliens and fairies, and a lot of those are similar substances. That could mean that they're the same thing, or it could mean that they're two discrete phenomena that have found the same modus operandi to interact with witnesses. So I feel like the thing that I can say with most confidence is that there is definitely a connection there. And if you don't think there's a connection there, you're just not paying attention to the data. I don't know if that means that they're the same thing or not, but there's a connection there.
Start with a description sort of the depth and breadth of how much of this stuff is out there, how far back it goes, how common it is all over the world.
Oh, it's an extremely common phenomena. A lot of anthropologists will point to the myth of Persephone, who was a Greek goddess, who was actually tricked by Hades into eating the seed from a pomegranate. And once she had consumed that, it had imprisoned her in the underworld for eternity, and she could only emerge every spring to rejoin her mother. But that particular food taboo actually manifests itself all over the world. The idea that anthropologists will put forth is that supposedly if food of the living keeps the living alive, then food of the dead keeps the dead dead. But you see Finnish traditions where a hero rejects a tankard of beer in the underworld because he knows it'll trap him there. There's a Mesopotamian myth about an entity who refused food from another god because they knew that although it promised immortality, they would never be able to return to the mortal world. There's a Japanese myth with this. In some South Pacific islands, there was this idea that you could actually go to visit your dead lover in the afterlife, but you must not consume any of the things that are there because you will be trapped there forever. So looking at how widespread this is, I could accept all of this as an outgrowth of the Persephone-Demeter story, but I really have a hard time believing that somehow that myth was transported over to North America, where you have First Nations tribes saying that taking food from Sasquatch will make you trapped with a Sasquatch. So there's some theme of commonality here that is really what speaks to me in these sort of subjects. I'm fascinated by these lines that weave their way between phenomena that on first glance look to be completely separate.
I think I remember you mentioning in the book, too, the Persephone and the pomegranate thing. There's a parallel to the Garden of Eden,
Absolutely. At
least in some versions.
Absolutely. It's interesting to see a lot of the etymology, the actual origins of the word surrounding the apple in the Garden of Eden. For example, in French, I believe, the term apple with different modifiers can refer to an apple or a tomato or I think even a potato, but also definitely to a pomegranate. And of course, we also see another parallel with some of Whitley Strieber's writing, where he actually seemed to recall a liquid that tasted like a rotten pomegranate being dropped on its tongue. So, pomegranates are one of those things that sort of wind their way through a lot of these tales.
We're going to take a break in about 3 minutes, so I wanted to maybe at this juncture tell the story that you start with in the introduction, Astri Olsdatter, a story from 1720.
Yes.
Can you remember the details?
Yes. Astri Olsdatter was a young lady in Norway who disappeared for several days, 5 days, I believe, in June of 1720. She was herding some cows in a valley when she saw what she thought was her employer. And he just seemed sort of strange, and there was a strange music drifting down from the mountains. And he said, "Hey, can you hear this too?" And she said, "Oh, I can as well." And being her employer, when he said, "Follow me," she dutifully followed him. But after some time, she was surrounded by several men with red shirts and black trousers and blue stockings. And her employer transformed into one of these people. So it was this idea that maybe he wasn't really her employer after all. And she was sucked into this mountain, and a large door shuts behind her, and she's just sobbing. And over the course of her time there, these beings tried to get her to eat or drink something on no less than 8 separate occasions. They tried to give her, put a cup to her lips and telling her to drink. They said that if she would just drink, they could stay with her forever, or she could stay with them forever, rather. And then it was only after her continuously refusing to eat or drink with them that she was eventually sort of spit back out into the real world, and she returned to her employer's farm. It was not, after all, her employer. And they nursed her back to health, and she felt like the ordeal had only lasted about 12 hours, and even though it lasted days and days. And she said that she hadn't eaten anything strange prior to the encounter, and she hadn't fallen asleep. So it seems likely that something really did happen to her.
So would a girl of 15 have known about, in Norway back in 1720, have known about the food taboo? Would that have been a common knowledge in that culture?
Well, therein lies the rub. I mean, you look at a lot of people in accounts all over the world and who seem to report these sort of things, and would they have known? I'm not sure. You know, there was another gentleman in Russia who was taken aboard a flying saucer, and he was told by the entities that he could not eat their food because it would change him and he would be forced to stay with them. I think that perhaps the food taboo in regards to the fairy folk of Scandinavia might have been as well known as it was in other Celtic countries in Norway. But whatever she did, it was a wise decision to not eat what she had. You know, I've always joked, we don't know anything about the people who ate the food and didn't return.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. You also say that there are similar tales in North American tribes, Cherokee, Pawnee. They have something called the Woodman, who tries to use food to entice people into something.
Yes, there's the I had mentioned the Tassanoqua, which is a term for Sasquatch, and the idea was that that they would wander through the woods and they would offer food to children, and if the children took the food, they would throw it into a big satchel on their back and take them off. It's interesting that you mentioned that as well. My parents were just on a Cherokee Indian reservation, and they spoke with a young man. The subject of my book came up, and he said, "Oh yes," he says, "we have little people in the forest, and we're always told that you never take anything from them." So again, this little thread that these gifts are not something that you should accept.
Joshua Cutchin is my guest. A Trojan Feast is his book. We'll hear a lot more stories coming up. And Nantucket Sleigh Ride from Mountain takes us into the break. Ah, it's a great song. Robin Trower, About to Begin. I thought it sort of set an ethereal tone, a little spooky, a little romantic. It's from an epic album, Bridge of Sighs. Check that out if you haven't heard it in a while. We're talking with Joshua Cutchin about his new book, A Trojan Feast. When we come back, we'll jump into some of the Celtic folklore tales that sort of started this ball rolling. Tales about encounters with elves and the fae folk. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Joshua Cutchin, early in your book, you have a chapter on lore and fairies. There's a warning from Warlock Merlin in which he says, "Bite no bit, drink no drop, or you will never see Middle-earth again." That goes way back, and you start with a story that it sounds almost like a modern alien encounter, but it's something that happened to this little boy on an island a long, long time ago.
Yes, you're referring to the are you, is it,
Saint
yeah, you're
Enda,
referring to, I'm sorry?
Saint Enda, young Brian Collins.
Oh, yes. It actually happened in the early 1990s.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, sorry. That's all right.
I saw the Saint Enda thing. It says circa 484. I didn't know what the, if that was referencing Brian Collins or not.
Right. Well, you find these things tend to happen at locations with quite a bit of history, and the Aran Islands are where this took place. And there was a couple of the first true Irish monastery was founded by Saint Enda on in 484. So that's where you got that from. No worries.
Well, tell the story on Brian anyway.
Well, no. I mean, the interesting thing is that you would expect this to be a story from back then, and it's actually just from the early 1990s. He was on holiday with his family in the islands, and he noticed two small men who were dressed in green with brown boots, and they were fishing on the shore, laughing and speaking in Gaelic. They were about 3.5 feet tall, and he thought they were sort of interesting, and he sort of snuck up behind them. And when he got there, they were gone, except they had a small pipe. And he picked up the pipe, took it back to the house that him and his family were staying in, and locked it in a drawer, and it disappeared. So it's another one of these wonderful little stories that you'd think that would have happened ages and ages ago, but actually was relatively recent.
Talk about this sort of the umbrella term of fairy and what it refers to, what it includes.
Well, it's interesting. The term fairy has really been co-opted by a lot of Disney-fied characters, and the tiny little winged ladies that you find in Victorian art are not very much like the elaborate taxonomy that you find when you actually look into fairy lore. I've always been fascinated by fairy lore because it isn't these light little entities that are here to help you and can be resuscitated by clapping. It's actually usually very dark and sinister entities who are sort of earth elementals, and they're found in pretty much every pantheon of any tribal people, from the Celts to the Native Americans to Africa. I mean, you have the Menehune in Hawaii, you have the Mogwai in China, the Duendes in Portugal, and the West Africans speak of the Azizas. And each of these entities had power over the earth, and they had a very specific offerings that you were supposed to give them if you wanted them to bless your household, or if you wanted them to leave you alone or give you good luck. And it was very wise to not cross them because they could blind you or give you bad luck or whisk you away to the fairy world.
I mean, it is pretty strong, these stories in Celtic tradition in the British Isles and Scotland and Ireland. And I know it seems like that's where, when you think about these stories, that's where they come from, but they're all over the place.
They really are. I mean, I think that in our culture, we do, in Western culture, we have a tendency to gravitate towards some of the old fairy tales. But you're right, they are widespread throughout the entire world. Almost every culture has this idea of these these usually little people. Of course, having said that, they weren't always little. You look at the Woodwose, who was a large, hairy wild man, which looks a lot like Sasquatch, carrying around a club through the woodlands of Europe. So all shapes and sizes, and they could had all sorts of crazy powers. It's almost, I jokingly referred to it almost as like the Pokemons of the ancient world.
You mentioned a couple of times in the book about Iceland, where these kinds of beings, it's not folklore, it's not old wives' tales stuff from long ago. I mean, it's a living reality for them, and it manifests itself in many ways, right?
Yes, I mean, this is something that a lot of Icelanders just really live with. It's just this assumption that certain large boulders have fairies in them, or fairy homes, or fairy schools. You'll find road construction that is halted so that they can actually either move a boulder with a blessing from the fairies that they've obtained through a medium, or sometimes you'll find that the road will actually wind its way around certain boulders or certain natural features to avoid upsetting the fairies. And, of course, you hear these wonderful anecdotal stories about earth movers shutting down and not turning back on, and people involved in construction sites having bad luck after they decide to just plow right through. There was a 1998 study by a newspaper in Iceland that people have cited a lot of times that claimed that 54% of the native Icelanders actually still believed that the elves, the huldufólk, still lived in their country.
Let's tell some stories about the food taboo, the exchanges of food, because it's, as you note in the book, it goes both ways. And one of the stories you told, this is from 1759, Jacob Jacobson returns from an errand for his father when he discovers a large, broad road before him. That also sounds like sort of a modern abduction kind of story. Tell the story.
It does, doesn't it? He was out doing some errands for his father, and he sees this road which he had never seen before. And, you know, it really does call to mind Jenny Randall's and the Oz effect that she talks about, how everything seems eerie and sort of off. And he goes down this road, being an inquisitive sort, and he sees this small village and goes into one of the buildings where he sees, quote-unquote, crowds of little people running back and forth, supervised by a tall, attractive woman. So again, this is there are parallels here to alien lore, where you have the shorter worker grays and the larger supervising gray. And the tall woman said that he should sit with them and feast. And the Jacob Jacobson, probably aware of the food taboo, declined, and he said that he would like to go away, and he said, "God, help me back to my father and mother," and immediately he was returned back to where the road had begun. So it's this wonderful little story that has a lot of parallels with modern abduction lore.
Then you got another one that's from more modern times. Abdul, I can't pronounce the last name, Mutalib, I think, disappeared in January 1982. This guy actually disappeared, so Kuala Lumpur.
That's about as good a job as I'd do with the last name as well, so no worries. Yes, he was at a guard post in Kuala Lumpur, and he disappeared. No one could find him, and when he returned, he vomited up worms and grass, and there are a lot of local legends in that part of the world about the Buni, which are elemental beings that take people to palaces, give them food. Now, here's something that becomes very interesting as a sort of a central theme of the book. The fact that worms and grass were vomited speaks to the nature of fairy food. You hear a lot of things about fairy food not really being food at all, but being detritus, being leaves and twigs and worms and even frogs that are cloaked with this sort of glamour to make it appear appealing, rather. In the Finnish myth that I mentioned earlier, the gentleman in the underworld, who is about to drink of the ale, takes a second look and notices that it's full of frogs and worms and actually isn't ale at all. This idea that somehow, again, subjective versus object, somehow they're making you see something other than what there really is.
So give me a range of the kinds of food that have been offered by different beings, different creatures that people have reported.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. The main categories that I found most often, and just a quick disclaimer, this was not a quantitative study, it was a qualitative study. I ran into a lot of issues with categorization. For example, in some modern-day alien encounters, people would be given, say, a pill that's dropped into water and turns in a different color. do we categorize that as an alien pill or an alien drink, or is it actually earthly food or drink? So I tried to stick to a qualitative analysis, trying to get the basic trends as best I could. The most common thing that you'll see offered amongst aliens and fairies is liquid. In fairy encounters, given the era in which people would encounter them, people were given ales and wine, things of that like. Today, people in abduction accounts are often forced to consume a liquid or a thick paste. A lot of contactees will report a liquid, but usually it's a sweet fruit juice of some sort. People also receive fruits and bread from aliens and fairies. Aliens tend to give pills as well. It's interesting. I approach this aware of the food taboo with Sasquatch, that if you were to eat from Sasquatch, you'd be trapped with Sasquatch, which is the parallel that I saw between all three. But as I continued to write the book, it was becoming more and more apparent that Sasquatch was sort of an outlier, which I think lends some credence to the idea that it is actually a biological entity in itself. Sasquatch tends to offer raw meat. You will rarely, if ever, see raw meat, or any sort of meat product, actually, in fairy or alien abduction. Now, again, this speaks to me in a very visceral way. In Western culture, you would expect to see meat in these encounters if they're all in the mind, because we are so obsessed with meat in the West, but you rarely, if ever, see that. You often see basically what amounts to healthy food, juices, breads, etc. In the rare instance that it's something different, it's usually a pill. So I find that really interesting.
You told a couple of stories in the book. I don't want to jump too far ahead or out of order, but back to the Sasquatch thing. You told a couple of stories I had not heard before, but they're great. They're amusing in a way, of people who report encounters with these Sasquatch type beings. Maybe the beings steal something from them, but they come back with something else as almost like a form of repayment.
Yeah, you know, since this book really it really looks at the exchange of food, the giving and taking of food between humans and these entities, it seems like there was definitely an opportunity for me to talk about Sasquatch habituation. I think a lot of habituators have come under fire for not obtaining concrete evidence when apparently they're in this relationship with Sasquatch, and I can understand that. For anyone unfamiliar with the term habituation, it's this idea that a sort of reciprocal relationship is developed with Sasquatch by leaving bits of food overnight for them to take, and in exchange for the food, Sasquatch will leave a feather or a river rock or something. But there are some really interesting cases that I found quite compelling. You'll find tons of cases about people leaving food high in a tree, suspended on a limb, that an animal would have to be either quite nimble or quite tall to get to, and I find those compelling. But one of the most interesting ones was a Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization report from Washington State that talked about 10 mice that were delicately wrapped in grass packages, almost like a little sushi platter, in exchange for a bag of apples that a habituator had left out. And it seems very apparent to me that there is no animal in the North American wilderness that can weave grass around a bunch of dead mice. So it's this interesting giving and taking and exchange. And there's a parallel with fairy lore there, too. I mean, I had mentioned how fairies tended to have certain offerings that they would like to receive, and I think that Bigfoot habituation is kind of a little bit of a variation on that. When a fairy didn't receive the offerings that it was promised, it would often wreak havoc. It would kill livestock. It would destroy property. And when you talk to habituators who cease giving food to Sasquatch, you'll often find talk of pets that are maimed, or livestock that's killed, or property destroyed. So it's another little interesting parallel between the different phenomena.
You had a story from Michigan about a Bigfoot witness who told a story about a summer in his childhood when chickens were stolen from the family's farm, the coop. Do you remember this one?
I really enjoy that story because it's again, another one of these parallels. Apparently, there were chickens that were being found missing from the family's farm throughout an entire summer. And the morning after one of the disappearances, the witness actually found about six catfish at the family's doorstep. and he had actually seen a Bigfoot on property earlier in the summer. The catfish were quite fresh to the point of still, you know, opening and closing their mouths and trying to breathe. But what was interesting to me is that none of the farm cats would touch them. And you'd think that anyone who has owned a cat knows that it wouldn't be out of the question to find one or two of those catfish missing. So the way that this ties into fairy lore is that you'll often find offerings that are left for the fairies will still be there in the morning. In certain Celtic folklore, this was because the essence of the food, the oomph, as it were, was taken from the food by the fairies. The Celts called this foison. And they said that any food that was missing this foison was unfit for any sort of consumption. And here's the interesting part, pets would often avoid it, where if pets did like drink the milk or eat the food that was left out for the fairies, they would get sick. So that's a parallel between those two. And you also look at modern cattle mutilation scenarios where scavengers oftentimes will not touch the carcass of a mutilated animal.
You told one story back in the Bigfoot part of the book where there's something called the Wild Woman of the Woods, described as a giant, hairy, bearded, black-bodied, big-breasted, wide-eyed female monster, to which I'm thinking, I might have dated her in my younger days, but the legend sort of, it's tricky business when you're thinking about exchanging food, because some of the legends say that these Sasquatch or Bigfoot would eat people, which... You know, I don't know. I haven't heard that one before. That was new to me.
Yeah, you find that in certain tribes, especially along the Alaskan coast, that you should probably avoid them. And a lot of these entities have I would say cannibalistic, but that would imply Sasquatch eating Sasquatch. But you hear a lot of, between aliens and Sasquatch, you've heard a lot of things about people being taken or harvested. But when you're taken by a Sasquatch, it usually looks like it was probably for breeding purposes. You find most of the Sasquatch abductees claimed to have been taken by the creature were female, and there are usually pretty salacious motives behind that. It's what was also interesting to me is why anyone would take food from a giant, hairy, bearded, black-bodied, big-breasted, wide-eyed female monster.
Yeah, it's, the same is true for the fairies and elves and things that might look less threatening, as you note in the book. I mean, it seems like they're trying to entice you to take this stuff for unknown reasons, and then you walk a fine line because you note that there are stories of people who refuse to take it, turn it down. They tick them off all the more.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting. There was a story of the man who encountered the Banshee, and the Banshee, who is actually one of the fairy folk. I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with the Banshee from Darby O'Gill and the Little People. But the Banshee offered this gentleman buttermilk on the road, and he knew that he shouldn't take it, and he didn't take it, and she still blinded him. So I guess that's better than being taken to the fairy realm, but sort of a lose-lose proposition.
What do you make of the stories of people who would consume something? Are there credible stories about somebody who drinks the drink or eats the food and they really truly are messed up by it? I mean, are there ones that you point to that you find to be credible and well-supported?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the lore says that if you eat fairy food, you're trapped in fairyland. But I think we have to take a look at what that might be describing and how it could maybe be describing something in a little bit different light. To be trapped, could that mean possibly being driven mad? In modern-day scenarios, if you eat the food and you're trapped in alien land, does that mean that you're going to be a lifelong abductee? Or does the food maybe even mean that you'll be killed? There are certainly tales of people who have taken fairy food and are driven mad. There are these Ella maids of Scandinavia and Germany who would dance alongside the roads at night, and they would entice people to drink their wine. And there was one folk tale of a man who was traveling in Denmark and drank the wine and lived. He wasn't taken to fairyland, but he returned home and was driven so mad by not being able to be with these beautiful women that he ended up going crazy and killing himself. So this idea of imprisonment, I think, needs to be broadened a little bit. You know, I mean, you could even look at the idea of Adam and Eve consuming forbidden fruit and being imprisoned outside of the Garden of Eden, being imprisoned in the world of toil and sin.
It makes you wonder, too, about the role of psychedelics. I mean, maybe drink this mushroom tea and you might think you're going crazy, but it's hallucinations caused by the stuff in the drink. We'll continue our conversation with Joshua Cutchin, author of A Trojan Feast, in just a moment. And if you do run into an elf or an alien, this is food you don't want to offer them. ZZ Top TV Dinners. Back in a moment.